On Chew the Fat this week, we are in London to chat with someone who is making huge waves right now across the food scene in Britain and beyond.
Ryan Riley is the founder of Life Kitchen, a charity which provides free cookery lessons to those undergoing cancer treatment whose sense of taste may have been decimated due to chemotherapy and their joy for cookery lost along the way.
With huge awards and many endorsements from chefs, food writers and celebrities, Life Kitchen is already becoming a force in the food world. We know Ryan well from our time living in London, so we wanted to chew the fat with him to allow listeners to get to know him a little bit better and understand why and how he started this amazing social enterprise and charity. I'm Russell.
And I'm Patrick, and this is Chew the Fat.
So I'm Ryan Riley. I'm a food writer and stylist and the founder of the award-winning Life Kitchen.
We all have to get to the award-winning. Yes, this is a recent addition to your bio, isn't it?
It is. I used to say just Life Kitchen, but now you've got to say award-winning because we recently won the Observer Best Ethical Food Project Award for Life Kitchen for our work around the country, giving free cookery classes to people who are living with cancer, focused on taste and flavour. And, you know, what we do is all about getting people to get them together in lovely environments, get them to enjoy food, get them to cook, which is quite a task sometimes, and get them to be involved with other people.
We're going to go a little bit further back. Let's go way before the foundations of Life Kitchen, which has been, what, about 18 months in the works now, is it?
Yeah, 18 months, but we probably launched in February of this year. Yeah. So technically 8 or 9 months, basically.
What a whirlwind. So a career as a food stylist and a food writer. Yeah. How did that come about?
Drunken idea with my best friend Kimberly. We lived in Streatham. We were making gyoza in the kitchen. And we said we should open a street food stall. So we drunkenly emailed Camden Market. And the next day we had a spot at Camden Market. And we had to open a street food stall because it was a drunken suggestion. And I rang my dad. I loaned $5,000 off him. He was a bit weirded out by it. And then we opened him for 2 years solid. We ran a street food stall at Camden Market with varying degrees of success. And from that, I decided, you know what? I like the food industry. Let's try it. So I applied to work for the likes of Sainsbury's and Waitrose. And I ended up working in the Sainsbury's magazine food team.
Have you got any training as a chef, or is it all just home cook knowledge?
It's all home cook knowledge. It's what I learned in the Sainsbury's magazine test kitchen. I think, you know, actually, they'll hate me for saying this, but I got fired from the Sainsbury's magazine test kitchen because I didn't have Leith's culinary training. And they thought I was too much effort. Well, like, where I am now.
Well, you showed them that they were right.
And to be fair, without that happening, I wouldn't be where I am today. So, and, you know, I went to their recent 25th birthday party. So, I mean, we're on great terms. Yeah. But, you know, the food industry is a difficult one, and it is so populated by people who are wealthy and can afford this training. And I couldn't and still can't. So I taught myself.
And there's no shame in it. We know it's a great accolade to be able to say you're a home cook and be proud of it. And it's amazing to see what you've done. And you've worked with the likes of Sainsbury's, but you do a lot of private clients as well for styling. We follow you on Instagram and we're like, oh my God, look where he's going.
I know, it's quite exciting, especially when I get the more commercial clients. I did an advert for Emirates. I did their entire advert on my own. And it's so funny because big brands like that don't really believe in food styling. They're just told they need it. So I went along to do the shoot, and they were like, oh, you don't need an assistant. It was in an aircraft hangar, and it took 3 days. I was like, I need an assistant. So I called my best friend, and I was like, you need to come help me. I'll pay you out of my money. And by the end of the 3 days, the shoot manager said to me, I'm so sorry, we've found a budget for your assistant. Here, we can pay her. We were wrong. And I was like, yes, it is a difficult job.
Underappreciated in all the ways possible.
Exactly. And it made about 8 seconds of the advert.
What? All of that effort for 8 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah.
3 days work.
Yeah, but it's still my biggest client to this day, so I'll let it happen.
I still love them.
I'll take it. Through all your work as a food stylist and a food writer, the idea of Life Kitchen came about, but it obviously came about through a great heart ache for you.
Yeah, so I'd had the idea for a little while, but you know, I founded Life Kitchen in memory of my mother, Krista, who I lost to small cell lung cancer. And I suppose when I lost her nearly 5 years ago next month in December, it was sort of like, you know, I couldn't really do anything back then. And then as my skills have developed and my contacts have developed, I was like, I've got to be able to do something. So again, I was drunk. And I thought, I'm going to tweet this little idea. And I tweeted saying, just want to do this cookery class, people living with cancer. It wasn't really going to be focused on taste and flavor then. It was just going to be focused on, you know, can I do something? Can I do something nice? And it kind of went viral overnight, you know, a couple hundred retweets. And then, you know, it got sent to our dear friend Nigella. And, you know, she came on board very quickly. And then we took a little bit of time to sort of look at the research. And I was originally going to collaborate with River Cottage, and it took 8 months to get that in the pipeline because everything got cancelled and Christmas was in the way. So eventually when we launched in February of this year, you guys know it's just been a whirlwind.
So 18 months in after the idea appeared in a drunken haze, is there anything that in hindsight you'd have changed?
You know what? No. You know, because everything happened so quickly, I haven't had any time to think about anything. And I've got so much more coming up in the next couple of months, which I can't talk about yet.
Oh, go on.
But as soon as I can, I will. But, you know, really exciting things, really big support. You know, I've had meetings recently with Marks and Spencers, who we're going to talk about doing a collaboration with. I'm going to host a special Christmas dinner with them later on this month for Life Kitchen patients. That's not announced yet, but there you go. And yeah, we're hoping to have them on board. I'm opening a cookery school next year. I mean, I didn't think any of this was going to happen when I started. And, you know, it's been really hard because it's not exactly made any money. Yeah. I mean, it's not even a charity yet. The Charity Commission are the slowest people I've ever met in my life. But, you know, we've been living on very, very small amounts of money to do this. But, you know, we've had 15 classes and several demos and over 500 guests and around the country. And you know, you guys know what traveling is like. It's expensive and it's difficult. So, you know, and food is not cheap. I chose the wrong sort of charity to run on a shoestring. But here we are.
In terms of what it is you do during the classes, do you want to explain kind of the whole process, what anyone who comes to Life Kitchen experiences?
Absolutely. So, we always start the class. There's sort of two setups. We tend to do it at places, real cookery schools, where they can get involved. But if we can't do it at places like that, we pop up a place like Duck and Waffle, the restaurant in the City of London, and we turn their private dining room into a pop-up cookery school. So for that sort of setup, we sort of set up chopping boards and we get them to chop everything and then it disappears like Blue Peter and comes back cooked, which is kind of a really nice thing to do, especially when you've got a team of like 100 chefs who wash up for you. I know, I'm doing one this evening actually, so I can do and fit those into really busy days. But a proper Life Kitchen class at somewhere like Jamie Oliver or River Cottage is a hell of a lot of work. And we start off with usually 3 to 5 dishes. 5 is ambitious because, you know, people are always less able than you think they are. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, like, you know, you get people who say, oh, like, I can chop. And then, like, okay, maybe you need a bit of help with that. Yeah. And that takes an extra 5-10 minutes of your time. And then suddenly you've lost 2 recipes. But we always start off with a demo. So I do something like our harissa salmon with fennel yogurt salad. And then I demo it, and then I send them away to try it. Now, that's been one of our most popular dishes. And we don't actually know why. Because we work with a lot of culinary stuff and also a lot of science. But this one fits into just culinary. And I don't get why it works for people, but it does. So we look at things like umami, which is our 5th taste. And we look at how that stimulates all of the other taste receptors. So if you have a sense of altered eating, if you have that different palate because of cancer treatment or because of something else, then you need to boost all of the individual taste receptors. And umami-rich foods like tomatoes and anchovies and parmesan all really help to boost that and also boost saliva production. And you get quite a lot of dry mouth through cancer treatment or the metallic taste. And we're trying to combat a lot of things by just recipes. You know, there's no medicine or anything involved. It's simply just food trying to give people pleasure. And that's, you know, quite a tricky thing. And especially when you introduce people to new tastes, the British palate is not as exotic as one may think with all of our food hype media these days. So, you know, harissa is quite new to a lot of people. Umami, about one person in the 500 that I've taught have heard of. And then we also use things like mint and cinnamon and wasabi and horseradish and mustard, because they all stimulate a thing called the trigeminal nerve. And that's the thing between your eyes, your nose, and your mouth. And this is a podcast. I was pointing to it, but you can't see that. But that's what sort of like burns when you have that horseradish. It doesn't burn on your palate. It burns in sort of the bridge of your nose. And we use ideas like mint, because mint stimulates that. If you think about toothpaste, if you have too much of it, you're like you like seize up in the face slightly. So we took that idea of toothpaste and then thought mint, and we start adding mint to things and cinnamon, and we're sort of developing recipes around the stuff that we know right now. But there's so much more. So we've just launched this big project called 5BasicTastes.com. I thought I'd keep it in on brand, talking about all of the tastes that we do. And that's just a short food survey where we're getting everyone who's living with cancer and experiencing taste problems to give us their information. And we're trying to find some common threads in that, because that can help. You know, it's quite difficult. You know, when I'm traveling around the country and talking to these people, I'm also teaching and running and washing up and cutting and cooking. And it's really, and running the social media and all of the classes. So we sort of centralized this and said, let's get people to submit. And we've had hundreds of responses so far. We want about 500, because then we can find these common threads and hopefully work out some new ideas.
So who else is on the team other than you? Or is it just you trying to run this mammoth operation yourself?
I mean, it's mostly me. My sister helps with some of the admin stuff alongside her full-time job. My best friend, Kimberly, is a chef, and she helps when she can. My dad's really brilliant. He's the director of, we have two things. So we have the charity, which is sort of in motion right now, and we have the social interest company. And my dad runs that, and that's what is building our cookery school. And it's really amazing because he's brought in these amazing companies like Sir Robert McAlpine, like billion-pound building firms, who are building a tiny little grade two listed gate lodge on the edge of a park in the northeast of England. And he's just running it and making it work. So there are people involved, but it's very like ad hoc basis and sort of when people have the time. And we'd love more, but we just don't have the money. Like, and I just don't really, we have lots of people offered to volunteer, but then you need lots of time to teach volunteers what to do. And I just don't have lots of time.
You should just record it in a podcast and explain it all out to people, and they can listen to it and educate themselves. You mentioned the cookery school, which I suppose when you drunkenly came up with the idea, did you imagine that that would be something that would even be happening?
No. I mean, that's a one-word answer. But I sort of had hoped that we'd get somewhere. And ever since I was little, I always wanted to have a bricks and mortar sort of thing, whether it was retail or something. And this is sort of my little dream come true. And, you know, it's been supported by big companies, and it's been kitted out by Fisher & Paykel, who are huge in Australia and New Zealand, but not that well known in Britain. And I just called them up. I said, do you want to support this? It was an instant yes. And it's like 40,000 pounds worth of amazing, beautiful, high-end kitchen equipment. Like, I could never afford that. Like, and yet we're getting it in this tiny little school in Sunderland. This is just people really wanting to help. For once, it's not just corporate social responsibility. It's actually, I mean, what do they get out of a tiny little cookery school in Sunderland? Yeah. And they said it, you know, 6 months ago, before we got all of the major hype that we have now, which is kind of fascinating. And I just love that.
And I guess a portion of it is you've kind of spent the past 18 months chancing it and just asking. And the act of just asking, and the worst they can say is no. And I think that's inspiring to everybody around and everyone tuned in, because the worst anyone can say is no. And that you have to ask for help, and help is there, but you just have to ask.
Yeah, and you know, I've asked, and people have said no a lot. But also I would say people have said yes more, which is kind of fascinating. And sometimes the people who I thought I needed them to say yes and have said no, I was like, where do you go from here? Then suddenly someone pops out of the woodwork and was like, you know, do you need some help with this? You know, I was at Nigella's two shows at the weekend, and we arranged that we could do a Life Kitchen collection there. So we had this little donation stall. You know, we did nearly $1,000 in a day. And the second she said, you know, my friend Ryan is outside, he's just this amazing charity, blah, blah, blah. It was just a flurry of 20-pound notes that I couldn't get quick enough into the box. And we had an electronic card machine, and people were fascinated that you could donate electronically. And, you know, just as soon as people hear about it, they get involved and they feel like they have a part of it. It's one in two of us now who are going to get cancer. It's three of us in this room right now. Yeah. And that's a terrifying fact. Yeah. And, you know, there are so many great people out there doing things medically. But what we do is just sort of holistically, I guess, just enjoyable, nice, fun times, you know. And there's not a lot of people who are trying to give that. So much of cancer is about survivorship and about will we live through this, you know, can we battle it, which are all loaded words at the moment. And I just wanted to do something that was enjoyable and nice and free and fun and tasty. Yeah, always delicious.
Always tasty. What I enjoy about seeing all that you're doing at the moment is whenever you put up images, all I see is smiles. And every single one of them is just people who are just so happy. And I've had family members who've sadly passed away from cancer. And the smiles is the thing that disappears so soon and so quickly. So it's nice that you're giving that, you know, the happiness. And it's such a break away from treatment, from worry. It's therapy in so many ways, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of the comments I get from my class, and I say this a lot, but it's sort of the comment that has stuck with me most. A lady once said to me, the reason this class works is because it's barely about cancer at all. And I think that just describes it in every way. And actually, our most recent Duck and Waffle class, there was a woman who said, this is the best night out I'd had since I got ill 2.5 years ago. And I think what works is that we put it in nice places. I'm not just popping up in your random community centre. You'll put it in interesting, nice places like Jamie Oliver, Dalesford, you know, our upcoming one at M&S HQ is even quite interesting because people don't get to see that world. And, you know, they're going to dress it and make it look amazing. And, you know, Dog and Waffle is 40 floors in the sky. And I think we just try to do things that are a bit more interesting. And, you know, I get asked a lot to do it in this community centre and do it in that, but it takes away from what Life Kitchen gives them. You know, these people don't often meet up with other cancer patients outside of a chemo ward. So suddenly they're there. People are sort of hinting at what they've been through, but no one's really talking about it. And if they want to, it's there to talk about. But actually, most of them drink Tattinger. That's Duck and Waffle's amazing contribution. Every class, they just bust out bottles of Tattinger. I'm like, I love you guys. And, you know, they just do that, and we cook, and then loads of people ask for photos, and I'm like, you do realize I'm not famous? And then they're like, but you are to me. And then I'm like, this is fabulous. And we just have this amazing time, and it happens at every single class. And you can see everyone in the first 5 minutes utterly terrified. Yeah. And no one knows what's coming. And then suddenly some glasses of Tattinger arrive, and I was like, well, this could be okay. And then they sort of come into it and start to relax and then start to chat. And then by the end of it, you can't get rid of them. And I'm like, I've got 3 hours here, guys. We're closing. Well, not Duck and Waffle. They never close. But in all of our other classes, you just get these people who, for the first time, have opened up and found their little crew of people. No one wants to be there because no one wants to have cancer. But if you can make the best of that situation, which they are, then you get a really good result. And people have found new friendships through that. And because cancer is so isolating. And for the first time, they're together with people who are similar, but no one's sitting there crying over the fact they have cancer. They're sitting there crying over the fact they screwed up their salmon or they screwed up the way that they chopped that veg. And I'm like, look, there's no rules.
Yeah. I'm seeing a theme here about chopping. There's a lot of issues with chopping going on here now. So
look, both me, Nigella, all of us home cooks out there, none of us are amazing at knife skills. But the thing is, I've been doing it for so long now that I'm slightly better than the guests, so I can just at least look like I know what I'm doing.
You're not one of those chopping like really, really fast with your fingers almost being cut off, are you?
If I try to do that, we'd lose them. Yeah. And honestly, I sometimes try and I'm looking at the guests and I'm like, don't. Just be a minute, guys. And sometimes I have to say, you're going to watch me chop fennel for a minute, and I know it's boring, but it's got to be done.
Yeah. It's that or there's another charity being set up just in case and you don't need that.
Hands, please. And so who attends the classes? Is it just those who are in treatment or is it their friends? Is it their families? How are you structuring the classes?
So it starts off with, we always invite a person living with cancer and then a friend or family member, a carer, whoever it is that they want to bring, because that person is often quite tired or ill and doesn't really want to cook sometimes, so we invite someone who can do that for them. And it sort of kills two birds with one stone, really. You get more people to know about it and to spread the message and get the recipes out there, which is an interesting thing as well, because, you know, quite a lot of times the person who's accompanying them is more scared than the person with cancer. They're like, I don't know, I don't cook or whatever, and they get into it and suddenly they realize that cooking is not that difficult once you get a few of the basics down. And can we just side note for a moment and talk about salt and the demonization of salt? That's the biggest thing I face in my classes. People are like, oh, my food doesn't taste of anything, and I'm like, oh, we talk through the recipe for it, and you immediately find out they're like, well, I don't use salt, and I'm like, sorry, what? And you wouldn't believe it. It's a lot of the people in my classes, and I've done this around the country and in France. Like, I have seen a varied spectrum of people, and they all just believe like salt is the demon these days. You know, it's like butter was. And I have to then say to them, it's the difference between a good and a bad dish. Yeah. you know, I just say to them, add a little bit now, and then they taste it and they say, add a little bit more, and then I say, add a little bit more, and sometimes like, whoa, too salty. I'm like, but now you know.
Yeah.
Now you know what it is, and that's a huge battle to face. Anyway, just I have to talk about this all the time, and I felt like I needed to bring it to a big audience.
This is my TED talk, and I'm done. You mentioned about the recipes that you come up with and how there's it's not as plain as just creating a recipe for flavor. It's elevated in so many ways. How do you test them and how do you create them and how do you know that they're working?
Well, a lot of good questions there. The recipes start with the ideas. So we start about, you know, the things that stimulate the trigeminal nerve or things that are umami rich, things that we know create taste. And then we create ideas and then we take them to the classes and we just test them with real life cancer patients. I mean, what other way is there to do it? You know, I am going to be writing a book at some point. I'll tell you more about that when I can. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be all tested with cancer patients. It's got to be, because I'm not just going to whack out a cookery book or whack out some recipes at our classes. I'd say, by the way, I just did this for you, enjoy. I mean, what would that do? So we literally develop and do tasting sessions. So I'm just collaborating with the World Cancer Research Fund, who are part of the an affiliate of the World Health Organization. I mean, you couldn't get more prestigious than them in this world. And they asked me to write 20 recipes, and I've been writing these for a year. They come out next March. So that's 20 recipes that I've been working on for over a year. And we're about to do the tasting sessions where we literally sit down and I cook 10 recipes at a time, little taster portions, and then people write down what they think, and we add more lemon, we add more salt, we add more soy. You know, we add all these little elements in to see what works for them. And then we find sort of the common ground in that. And that's really comprehensive. You won't find many recipes tested as many times as they are within Life Kitchen.
And actually, we know from just cookery writers and everything, it's normally like two or three times tested to make sure.
The time is on the shoot, is when they're photographing it for the final piece.
Yeah.
And you know that very, very well. So it's a very comprehensive. Not to be negative, have you found that sometimes there is someone who just doesn't get it when they're on a class?
I wouldn't say it doesn't get it. I'd say sometimes the recipes haven't got enough stuff in them for them. We did a piece for the one show, full camera crew, and there's a lady who's like, this just doesn't taste like anything to me. And I was like, this is the worst thing ever. There's a camera crew right here. And I actually just stood there with her and I said, look, let's work on this dish. It was the pineapple tagus, which is probably our most famous recipe now.
Stop. Everybody needs to try these.
They're amazing. And the reason they work is because the pineapple stimulates saliva production, but it also is really good at helping mask the metallic taste. And then we cover prawns with chili, spring onion, coriander, and lime juice. And all of that is a fresh, powerful boost of flavor. And if you haven't tasted anything, and if you're not used to cooking with those ingredients, which who is really, it can be really a major surprise. And it's the reason we do it at most classes, because it always... If they haven't got anything else from it, they can see that these elements can be put together and made to work. And in the example of the lady from the one show, she couldn't taste it. So we just put on two more limes, we zested over some more lemon juice, and we muddled it together, extra chili, and she could taste it. And it is just sometimes about really just slamming it with flavor, yeah, after flavor after flavor. People in my class will tell you I talk about layering all the time. I just say, I try to explain cookery as... it's all just layering. So adding salt is adding a layer. Adding pepper is adding a layer of flavor. And people can sort of understand a bit of a building block. Yeah. And I just think, for example, that dish, adding the extra lemon was adding another layer and adding the lime. And it just sometimes is just about going that little bit further than what you're comfortable with, mm, or what you think might work. Because if you've got that diminished sense of eating, then you've got that opportunity there to sort of push your palate beyond what you're used to or what you think you can handle. And you'll see what results come of that.
You kind of come from two worlds. So you're all about the styling and how things look, and they're pretty and they're enticing. And then you have this whole other world that's all about flavor and taste and ingredients. So how did those two come together?
I think I actually started off in taste before anything as a child. I'm probably the most weirdest cookery writer you'll ever meet, because I don't like cold food really. Like, I like food that's meant to be, like, for example, if you go to Greg's and you get a pie, it has to be warm for me to eat it. Like, I can't stand to eat it when it's cold. And I've always been about that level of comfort. And I think comfort and flavor are so intertwined in each other. And that's it was just was my life. I just grew up wanting to eat this nice, warm, comforting, delicious food. And I do like some cold food. I mean, I'm not saying I don't. I really do. But I think like cold food that's meant to be cold and hot food that's meant to be hot. And I think growing up, I was just always so obsessed with those two things that I always wanted to find the cold food that was the most flavorful. Because what the hell's the point in eating it if it's not got any flavor? And then when I fell into the food world and the food styling industry, I just liked the way it looked because I just liked the way things were pretty and could entice people in. And I liked that I could do it because in art in school, I was terrible. I was probably the worst. So, you know, and food styling is a sort of art. It's like arranging things and making it look pretty. And I just loved the freedom of it. So I guess I've started out in flavor, ended up in visuals, and now I've just fused them together. And we do also teach a tiny bit of food styling at the classes, because if you've got that altered sense of eating, you might as well try and make it look as pretty as you can on the plate first, so you get something else out of it. Because we do eat with our eyes. Yeah. Even the beige brown stuff, which I think always looks amazing, yeah, and enticing.
After you open the school, are you still having classes on the road? Is this traveling still, or has everyone to head up to the school to attend a class?
Well, I would never wish it upon anyone to have to come to Sunderland all the time. I mean, I love the place, but
I didn't want to say that.
I love the place, but no, that there will be a certain amount of classes held there. There will also be community classes. I'm going to do really cheap as we can financially manage, try to make really cheap community classes that where we teach veg cookery for like £20. A Jamie Oliver class or a Dalesford class or River Cottage class, £100, £150. I'm a working class boy from the Northeast. My friends ain't going to pay that. So if we can work out a way to do a little roasted vegetable class for £20 where people can get involved and take their dinner home from it, and you know, if we can do that and build flavour and ideas before people get ill, if it's one in two of us, I mean, it's nearly everyone. So if we can do that and we can host a certain amount of Life Kitchen classes that a year, we'll also host what I call the Big Seven, which is River Cottage, Jamie, Dalesford, ones in Newcastle, Manchester, Scotland and Wales, and Ireland very soon, hopefully. So yeah, we will still be travelling because I also like it because, you know, people are ill and people do can't really always make it to Sunderland. But, you know, when we did River Cottage, someone flew from Belfast. So people are committed. That was the first one. She didn't know what she was getting herself in for, and yet she came. And people have done that in Dalesford. They've travelled hundreds of miles. So I know by having a base for this in the Northeast is not a bad place. 2 hours from Scotland, 3 hours from London, 2 hours from wherever else there is in the country. And it is pretty central. And it's outside of London for once, something that is not the M25 yeah. bubble. Which, you know, I love London, but I also hate London. Like, I love living here, but also I'd much rather wouldn't. But, you know, our lives are here. My life is here. Life Kitchen isn't here. And that's what I love about it. It can be anywhere.
Bringing up Ireland, and we've discussed this ourselves online quite a lot with each other. I personally would love to see it. You personally would love to see it as well over in Ireland. So let's go into Fantasyland, where you can just put it out there and say, what do you want? What do you need to make Life Kitchen happen in Ireland?
It's pretty simple. It's a venue. We need a cookery school who can help us put it on. I need you two to co-host with me because I don't know anyone else there and you guys at least understand cookery. So we can all do it. And it's really simple. I just need, you know, I don't really know the supermarkets over there, but I'm pretty sure we can get really good produce from listening to your podcast. You know a few people. But yeah, mostly a venue. You know, when I went to Ballymaloe, for example, that was the most insane, one of the most insane places I've ever been. But, you know, we haven't been able to do it there yet, but we'd love the opportunity to do it somewhere in Ireland. And I just, yeah, this is my little shout out to anyone who wants to do it. Get in touch with me or the boys and let's make this happen.
And when you say about venues, does it have to be a cookery school?
Well, preferably a cookery school, or you can do things like we do with Duck and Waffle, where we turn their private dining room into a pop cookery school. So a restaurant with a private room can work. It just has to be amazing and fun and an experience.
In terms of how can everyone else help, how can everyone who's tuned in to this, how can they help you to grow this, and how can they help to spread the word?
There's so many ways. You know, right now we've just set up a new email. It's at volunteer@lifekitchen.co.uk for volunteers. And we've been flooded with people, but there are always skill gaps because our industry is so specific in certain ways. there are only some things that people who know this industry can do. And, you know, recipe testing, for example, is quite a skill, and especially what we do. So we'll test it with the guests, but we also need someone then to sharpen up and make sure we have all those measurements right, you know, for when we publish these things. We need money. I mean, who doesn't in a charity? You know, you can do that by going to lifekitchen.co.uk and donating to support us. We need fundraisers. All of the people who just go around and do things on their own, who do supper clubs, who have whatever, and donate it, it just raises awareness. And I think if you do have someone who's living with cancer in your family, just tell them about Life Kitchen and see if it's something they want to do, if it's something they want to get involved with. Because it's not a problem for everyone with cancer. You know, we've looked at statistics that range from 50% to 80%. And obviously everyone I've ever met has experienced it because they come to us. But there are some people coming through on our new research website that say, doesn't affect me, and that they are living with cancer. So I think, you know, we just need so much help, is what I'm saying, across everything, fundraising, recipe editing, and more classes in different places. Because, you know, where we are right now, is varied as I can make it, but there are people in different parts of the country that we haven't even made it to yet. So, you know, if there is somewhere that you want to do it, just shout out and we'll try and make it happen.
This year, by the way, how old are you again?
25.
Make me sick. at the age of 25 this year, you won an Observer Food Monthly Award, which is one of the most coveted awards ceremonies in the food industry here in Britain. So huge congrats, and we were delighted for you when that happened. It was for Best Ethical Project, is that correct?
Yeah, Best Ethical Food Project. And I'd known about it for 2 months and I couldn't tell anyone. I almost told a few people, but I couldn't tell anyone. And I was so desperate to just get it out there, because I've always wanted to go to that award ceremony, because it is so amazing and the goodie bag is so great.
I've heard amazing things. It looks
so good.
I know. And actually the people at my chicken waffle class tonight get a surprise OFM goodie bag, courtesy of The Observer.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, spoiler alert, but this has happened, and yeah, so it doesn't matter. Oh, no. So that whole thing must have been like, I say a shock, but at the same time, you've worked so bloody hard for it. So a great pat on the back and a great endorsement too.
Definitely. And I'm so proud of it. And we have worked really hard. But the moment I found out, I was on my way back from B&Q in the back of my boyfriend's car with a tile rail going over the two seats. And I was sitting in the back because there was no room for me in the front. And I went to my junk email and I just happened to be checking it that day. And I found out that I'd won. And I was like, my life is so unglamorous. And it was just one of those amazing things. And I was like, I've won. And my boyfriend was like, what? With a tile rail across us, 55 boxes of tiles in the front. And it was just one of those days where it was total polar opposites. And I guess that's my life. You know, Life Kitchen is, I always call it a luxury brand, because we do give people nice places, nice food and great people for free. You know, and we don't just, I think I really, really want to redefine what charity is. I think I don't get involved with as many charities because they don't look and don't feel and don't give in the way that I would. I think I probably, let's call it a millennial charity. I just want to just make it that little bit more. I don't see why charity has to have so many, you know, strings to get anything from it. You know, we just say, we're having cookery class, come along. Here's all this nice stuff. Here's Nigella. Here's Sue Perkins co-hosting it. You know, like, it doesn't have to be complicated, and so many charities make it complicated. And I just want to give it a fresh approach where people want to get involved, because it looks amazing, it is amazing, it's doing good, and it's free and fun and out there, and just isn't a normal thing.
It's an experiential charity. Sounds like a brewery, but a craft charity.
Craft charity, I like it, I like it. Artisanal.
And in terms of, just finally, we kind of go into support. It has been incredible, because I say a lot of people have heard about it through, you say, mentioned Sue Perkins, who has been an amazing host and friend to you for quite a while with the project. And then Nigella, Hugh Fernie-Whittenstall, all jumped on board very early on.
Hugh Fernie-Whittenstall came because I was on Radio 4, the Today programme. His people called my people, which was me.
It's you with a different accent.
Hello, my head's not available right now. Please leave a message. Yeah, so his people called my people, me again. And yeah, and we just made that happen. Sue Perkins tweeted me saying, if you ever need a specky-eyed twonk, her exact words, then get in touch. So I obviously did. Nigella, I knew her home economist, and I sent it to her, said, do you think she'd be interested in this? And then she followed me on Instagram, best day of my life. And, you know, she's been a huge, very, very vocal supporter, which is amazing. Because as you guys know, I mean, she's one of all of our heroes. And she's, like, the most iconic, beautiful, incredible cook. And there's this little me who's working class boy from Sunderland trying to do something. And I always really appreciate everyone's support. You know, Jamie Oliver loaned me his cookery school. You know, he follows me on Twitter, but I've never met the man. And just, like, it's just an incredible flurry of bake-off people and just all those people that have helped get it out there. And, you know, I had this hate comment on The Guardian the other day that said this just feels like such a celeb lovey project and just feels so incredibly PR. And I was like, well, I just don't understand how, because I didn't ask for any of them to get involved. They just came along and said, here we go, let's do it. And here it is. And I just can't help that so many amazing people want to be involved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're always looking for more. So, you know, more people who can help us get it out there. I don't think we would have been so big if without those people.
And one last question, and I don't want to ask, would your mother be proud? Because I know she would be, because you're working every time. Yes. Would she enjoy Life Kitchen?
No, she wouldn't. She would come. I think she'd be terrified of being in a room with other people who were ill. Mm. And because I think she was so scared of death. And I was the one she always confided in that moment. You know, I was her carer. I was also at college and my dad was at work. And I was the only one who was ever around for her occasionally to sit on the sofa and watch Holmes Under the Hammer and cry with. And I know she would be so scared. She would enjoy it in the end. She wouldn't enjoy it in the beginning. She would have loved the free Tanger. But yeah, overall, I know she'd be proud. And I know she would have liked it in the end. But I think it wouldn't have been something she would have jumped at the chance to come to, which is quite funny because it's all in memory of her.
And just give everyone again her name.
Yeah, Krista Riley, my mother. And yeah, like I say, everything I do is sort of in memory of her. But it sort of brought all of my family closer together as well. You know, my dad and my sisters and, you know, my dad's new partner, Grace. Like, there was a new part of my life that's emerging, and it all is in memory of my mother. And I think it's quite strange because I've done a lot of TV because of this, and sometimes my nan calls me up and she's like, I've just seen her on the TV and I'm crying, and I'm like, oh god, I forgot to tell you. And it's opened up a different world for my whole family. But I think my mother would be annoyed at not telling my nan that her dead daughter was going to be on TV. I mean, it's honestly happened quite a few times. You think I would learn from it? But overall, yeah, that's me.
As mentioned throughout, if you'd like to support Life Kitchen, please go to their GoFundMe page, which is gofundme.com/lifekitchen1. Follow them on Twitter @LifeKitchen or on Instagram @LifeKitchen_.